From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Paradise Lost, Greed, Sex Slavery, Forced Abortions, and Right-Wing Moralists is the headline of a story in the current edition of Ms. Magazine. The story describes the sweatshops in the Northern Mariana Islands, a territory of the U.S. The article investigates how lobbyist Jack Abramoff and Congressman Tom DeLay blocked congressional attempts at reform. We'll talk with the reporter Rebecca Claren and the executive editor of Ms., Catherine Spiller. Also, the hidden story of women who surrendered children for adoption in the era before Roe v. Wade. We'll talk with Anne Fessler, whose own search for her mother led her to learn about the maternity homes where unwed pregnant women often went to keep their pregnancies hidden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of your clothing with labels that say Made in the USA, or Made in Saipan, USA, or Made in Northern Mariana Islands, USA, may have been made in sweatshops on islands thousands of miles away by garment workers who were nearly indentured servants. Efforts to reform those conditions were repeatedly stalled in Congress in efforts led by Congressman Tom DeLay and lobbyist Jack Abramoff. How DeLay and Abramoff did it and what the consequences have been is the subject of an article in the current edition of Ms. Magazine titled Paradise Lost, Greed, Sex Slavery, Forced Abortions, and Right-Wing Moralists. My guests are the reporter, Rebecca Claren, and the executive editor of Ms., Catherine Spiller. The Northern Mariana Islands were one of Jack Abramoff's first big lobbying accounts. Located in the Pacific, the islands have been a U.S. territory since 1976 and are exempt from U.S. labor and immigration laws. The Marianas are a territory of the United States. What advantages did that give the Marianas economically in terms of having clothing factories that then sold their garments in the United States mainland?
It meant that the clothing manufactured on the Marianas could say made in the USA. They could be then sold in the United States without any quota restrictions on the amount of clothing that was being sold. So it was estimated at one time roughly $2 billion a year of garments were being sold in the U.S. that had been manufactured in the Marianas. No quotas and no tariffs, because it was like bringing garments in from Texas or California to New York. So no tariffs, no quotas, made in the USA label, substandard minimum wages, and no real control over working conditions.
Rebecca, why are there so many clothing factories in the Marianas? And maybe you can mention the names of some of the companies that have factories there.
They're subcontractors. Companies like Ann Taylor, J. Jill, The Gap, Ralph Lauren, they don't actually manufacture their own clothing there. They subcontract to different companies there. And they do this because, for two reasons. Because the Mariana Islands are part of the United States, the labels on the clothing that's produced there can say made in the USA. And yet they can do this because it's this different situation and different dynamic there. The islands have a different set of immigration and labor laws than pertain to places in the States. So they have a substandard minimum wage, and they have an expansive guest worker program where they bring women from poor Southeast Asian countries to work there. So that means that they can produce the clothes a lot more cheaply than they could in, like, California, for example.
The Marianas were a client of lobbyist Jack Abramoff's. In fact, the Marianas were described as the client that really helped make his reputation, that really helped establish him. What did they hire him to do?
Well, they hired Abramoff in 1995, the government of the Northern Mariana Islands, because by then enough information had begun to come out and some members of Congress began to push for reforms to increase the minimum wage and to establish stricter enforcement of labor laws and to close these loopholes in the immigration controls that had led to the flooding in of foreign guest workers who, at the whim of their employer, could be deported. So they couldn't even complain if the work conditions were sweatshop-type conditions, which they were. So there had begun to be a real move for reform. And Abramoff was brought in because of his relationship to the leadership, especially in the House. And he delivered for them. He and his team, over several years, brought in over $11 million in lobbying fees. But he immediately set about to make sure that any of these reform bills that would pass, say, the Senate, and frequently, by the way, they did unanimously pass the Senate bipartisan support for increasing the minimum wage and correcting these abuses, that he would make sure they were killed in the House. And he did that by developing a close relationship with Tom DeLay, who would make sure that these bills died in the House Resources Committee and never made it to the floor for a vote.
Now, one of the tactics that Jack Abramoff used was, to help postpone or kill reform legislation, was to fund trips by congressmen to the Mariana Islands, junkets, basically. What did he try to accomplish with these junkets, and what were they like?
Well, he even bragged in correspondence to the governor of the Northern Mariana Islands that his most effective lobbying tool was arranging these junkets, many of them all expense paid. Over 100 members of Congress or their staff and families ended up going on these trips in the mid to late 90s. It's a beautiful island, by all accounts, a resort atmosphere, beautiful seas. And that's mostly, of course, where these trips ended up, although they had to take the obligatory visit to one of the prearranged, approved garment factories. So they only were allowed entry into model factories. Tom DeLay was one of the recipients of one of these trips, he and his daughter and his wife, and over time, six different of his top aides, back and forth, some of them to the islands, all so that he could speak firsthand, I guess, about what he had seen there.
So Tom DeLay ended up working against reform in the Mariana Islands. What were his tactics to get congressmen to not vote for reform?
Well, Tom DeLay was in a leadership position for the Republicans in the House and had tremendous influence over whether bills would be scheduled for a vote, so that if somehow these reform measures made it through the Resources Committee, although they didn't, Tom DeLay was always there as the backup so that if something came out of committee, he could simply make sure that the vote in the House was never scheduled. And without the vote in the House, the Senate's actions didn't make any difference because you have to have both houses to pass legislation. And in this case, the legislative efforts were focused on increasing the minimum wage and establishing U.S. government control over the immigration system in the Marianas. So in all cases, 29 different bills were killed in the House Resources Committee, some of which had been passed unanimously by the Senate. So it was a very effective strategy that Abramoff employed, focusing on the Resources Committee. Most of the Republican members of that committee, by the way, made trips to the Marianas. So it was a very effective strategy, always knowing that if it got through committee, Tom DeLay was there to make sure nothing would really pass.
I just wanted to add that not everyone who went to the Mariana Islands walked away feeling good about the situation. Frank Murkowski, former senator from Alaska, he went and was appalled by what he saw and came back to D.C. and drafted reform legislation that then ended up passing unanimously in the Senate.
Well, Rebecca makes a good point because in both cases, in not only in the Senate, and Senator Murkowski was the leading proponent of reforms in the Senate, but in the House, too, there was tremendous bipartisan support for reforms. In fact, one of the bills had so many co-sponsors in the House that it was such a clear majority that if they'd simply taken a vote on it, it would have passed. And we would have had new minimum wage requirements for the Marianas and new immigration requirements. But that's how effective the Abramoff delay web of influence was, that they could, even when a bill had majority support in the House, they could kill it in committee to make sure that these reforms never became law.
Now, Tom DeLay told the Washington Post that the Marianas were a petri dish for capitalism. And on one of DeLay's trips to the Marianas, he said, "When one of my closest and dearest friends, Jack Abramoff, your most able representative in Washington, D.C., invited me to the islands, I wanted to see firsthand the free market success and the progress and reform you have made." And then DeLay went on to praise the governor, and he said, "You are a shining light for what is happening in the Republican Party, and you represent everything that is good about what we're trying to do in America in leading the world in the free market system." And Grover Norquist, founder of Americans for Tax Reform and one of the most powerful conservative leaders in Washington, promoted the Marianas as models of free enterprise. Rebecca, you went to the Marianas to see what the conditions were actually like at the clothing factories there. Why don't you describe some of the things that you saw?
Well, Martin Van Krogh, the photographer, and I were able to get into one of the factories, and you have to assume that because we were granted a tour, it is one of the very best factories there. And indeed, it was well lit. There was room in the aisles, but the women there are working really long hours, often 20 hours a day. They almost seem as if they are a part of the machinery. They are so intent on the job at hand. The air is thick. It's quite dusty. Under OSHA regulations, they should all have masks, but people told me they never have that unless there was a tour that day for OSHA or a visiting member of Congress. So they would make makeshift pieces of cloth that they would put across their nose and mouth. Women told me that with those long hours, at times you become exhausted and the needle will just go right through your finger. There's counters over the sewing machines that tell how many pieces of a garment they've completed in an hour. And if you aren't meeting that quota, you may not be eligible for overtime. You may not be eligible at the end of the year for your contract to be renewed. There's constant pressure on these women to be working like machines.
My guests are Rebecca Claren, who wrote the article on the Marianas in the current edition of Ms., and Catherine Spiller, the executive editor of Ms. Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about an article in Ms. Magazine investigating the efforts of Congressman Tom DeLay and lobbyist Jack Abramoff to block efforts to reform working conditions in the Northern Mariana Islands. My guests are the reporter Rebecca Claren and the executive editor of Ms., Catherine Spiller. The Marianas are a commonwealth. They're an American territory, so American immigration laws do not apply in the Marianas. So a lot of the women who are workers at these clothing factories come from other countries, China, the Philippines, Thailand, I believe, as well. These women are poor, and they come to the Marianas thinking that they'll find better work there. But they come as guest workers. Rebecca, what does that mean?
Well, what that means is that they are only there at the behest of their employer. And if their employer doesn't want them there anymore, they have to leave. And one thing that is critical to understand about this dynamic, which sets up a situation which has been compared to something like indentured servitude, is that for the privilege of getting a job in the United States, these women pay recruitment fees, which can be upwards of $7,000. They come from poor villages. The garment workers mostly come from China. They don't have that kind of money. If they work in a factory in China, they're making about 60 cents an hour. So they borrow this money either from their family, often from their entire village. Often they borrow it from Chinese mafia moneylenders who can charge, I was told, up to 20% interest. So these women come over with these huge, huge debts that they have to repay. And they can't afford to lose their jobs. And that sets up a system of incredible vulnerability. We think, before I went over there, I thought, who wants to work 20 hours a day? That's awful. But no, these women want to work as much as they possibly can to pay back those fees, because until they pay back those fees, they can't start even saving any money. And because they're there as guests, their contract is only for a year at a time, and then they may get the chance to get their contract renewed. Women are usually told by their recruiters, oh, you'll be able to stay for several years. But if they do something wrong, if they say they don't want to work that overtime, if they get pregnant and decide to keep their child, they're mostly asked to leave. In every case, actually, they were told, as I was told, they were asked to leave.
Is this only if they're single or if they're married too?
If they're married as well. As a guest worker, their employers are responsible for all their medical care as well. And their employers don't want to deal with anyone who's sick, and they don't want to deal with paying for a pregnancy. And so women just have a general expectation that they're going to have to get an abortion. I was taken on a little abortion clinic tour, and I went and saw at least four different places that outside our signs that say massage oils, Chinese medicine, acupuncture clinics. And you apparently can go. It's very easy. You go into one of these clinics and you get a pill. It's what we would call in this country a medical abortion. And you get some pills and then you will have an abortion there. And, of course, these are people that running these clinics that have no – there's no oversight. They don't have any certification to be doing these sorts of procedures.
Rebecca, were there other themes that emerged from interviewing – and you interviewed about 30 women who were guest workers in the Marianas?
I would say that the sense of desperation is palpable. The fear of these women are palpable. They don't want their photo taken. They are living – in a lot of poverty because of this pressure to pay back this money. I visited one night, Martin and I went, it was a rainy night. We went down this dirt road to visit where some of these women are living who have chosen not to live in the factory-owned barracks where they would have to pay money that was taken out of their salaries. They instead are choosing to live in places where corrugated tin roofs, the concrete slabbed floor, the quote-unquote kitchen are just a few hot plates on a slab of concrete and some water and plastic buckets. 9 people sharing one toilet. They can't afford to really buy much food, and so they just are living on frozen vegetables that they buy.
So the kinds of problems that you're talking about, bad working conditions, guest workers who are virtually indentured servants, women who get pregnant and feel like they have to have an abortion or else they'll lose their job. With the reforms that were proposed in Congress, the reforms that were blocked by Tom DeLay with Jack Abramoff, would those reforms have addressed the kind of problems that you're talking about?
Yes, significantly so. First, just increasing the minimum wage would have made these women's lives so much easier to pay them at least the $5.15 that is the minimum wage standard here in the States.
So these reforms would say that American labor laws would have to apply to the territory of the Mariana
exactly.
Islands.
Exactly. And many more resources were needed to make sure that these laws, not only minimum wage, but OSHA laws for safe working conditions. And if a worker filed a complaint, that they couldn't be fired and summarily deported. All of those kinds of issues could be addressed through these reform bills that dealt with both the immigration as well as the minimum wage. And so, and by the way, these reforms are still languishing in Congress. Congress could still act to correct these situations so that women there have a more decent life and are not abused so by these employers.
What about American immigration law? Would those laws apply to the Mariana Islands if the reform bills were passed? And would that affect the virtual indentured servitude that the guest workers face there?
The immigration reforms would help enormously as well. It would ensure that these kinds of shadow contracts where the workers were having to sign secret agreements to get abortions if they became pregnant and other, you know, not to complain if they were not treated well. And then if they're not treated well and they file a complaint, if U.S. immigration law applied, they couldn't be summarily deported and sent back to their homeland owing these huge debts that Rebecca was talking about. So those kinds of reforms are critically needed to correct these abuses. The other immigration reforms would bring about less sex trafficking. Not only are sex workers on the island, many of these garment workers are former garment workers, but many of them are trafficked, underage girls as well, trafficked to the Marianas, told they're going to be working in restaurants or hotels and end up working in brothels. Those kinds of abuses, too, would then come under our own immigration authorities and could be addressed.
Although Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay were successful in blocking legislation that would have reformed conditions in the clothing factories in the Marianas, recently there were some changes made. Anyways, the Marianas were always exempt from certain tariffs because they're a territory of the United States, so they weren't subjected to those tariffs. How did the GATT treaty last year level the playing field?
What that meant is that since those tariffs that had been applicable to Chinese or Vietnamese companies, it had meant that it made a lot of sense for them to set up shop in the Mariana Islands because they didn't have to pay those fees anymore. But once those tariffs were lifted, why set up shop in the Mariana Islands, where even though it's a substandard minimum wage, you have to pay workers $3.05 an hour? You could set up that factory in China and pay workers 60 cents an hour, and you aren't, because there's the GATT treaty has been lifted, they don't have to have a quota system, they don't have to pay those additional fees. So it drove away the incentive that a lot of businesses had for setting up garment factories in the Marianas.
So are garment factories in the Marianas closing down now?
The factories are closing down by quite a bit, in fact. And what that means is that you have this glut of workers. Even though factories are closing down, there's still an incentive for the recruiters in China who get a cut and some money from all of those fees that the women are paying to bring them over. So they're still continuing to bring people over to the islands, even if there's not necessarily jobs, even if those factories know that they're going to close up shop in a month or 2 months after these women arrive. And so you have all these people who are on the Mariana Islands as guest workers who are desperate to find jobs. Again, they have those big fees. They have to pay them back. This is basically a big coral reef, these islands. There's no natural resource extraction to speak of. And the other real industry on the island is tourism. There are big hotels that serve mainly Japanese and Korean tourists. But there are not that many jobs, especially for Chinese workers who may not have very good English. So what people end up doing is there's a thriving sex industry on the island. There's a red light district called the Garapan, and you walk around at 7 o'clock at night, and there are former garment workers who are now working as prostitutes.
More on the Marianas in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Washington Spies, the story of America's first spy ring by Alexander Rose. From Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start June 5th at capella.edu. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Before legalized abortion, many single women who got pregnant were encouraged to hide their pregnancies by going away to a maternity home, then giving up the child for adoption. Coming up, Ann Fessler talks about her new book, The Girls Who Went Away. And we continue our interview about the Mariana sweatshops. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about an article in the current edition of Ms. Magazine investigating the role of Congressman Tom DeLay and lobbyist Jack Abramoff in blocking reforms in the Northern Mariana Islands. The islands are a territory of the U.S., which is exempt from American labor and immigration laws. The Ms. article reports that these exemptions have made it possible to set up sweatshops with employees who are nearly indentured servants. Rebecca Claren wrote the article. Catherine Spiller is the executive editor of Ms. Magazine. She proposed the story. Are there still bills before Congress now proposing reform in the Marianas?
There's still interest in Congress to reform the situation in the Marianas and, frankly, to also address the fact that so many of these workers are now stranded there as the garment industry is closing factories. So there's tremendous interest, bills even that just continue to sit there, but no real effort to move them still, even though Abramoff is now out of the picture and Tom DeLay will soon resign. It's going to take a push. It's going to take outrage by people in this country who believe what has happened there is horrible and that the U.S. Could still act to correct the situation. And we hope that this attention, renewed attention, is maybe going to spur interest in correcting the situation there. We also need... Terry, an investigation of what happened there. You know, most of what's come out on these Abramoff scandals has to do with gambling interests here in the United States. But real people were terribly hurt by these scandals. Thousands and thousands of women who toiled in these factories making clothing for the American marketplace.
Now, the government of the Marianas apparently now wants Jack Abramoff's lobbying firm to pay back millions that the government paid his company. The government is now saying that Jack Abramoff's firm overbilled the government. What's that about?
Well, it's interesting because they certainly got what they paid for, which is no reforms ever got through the United States Congress. Those are some of the questions that should be looked at either in congressional hearings or an independent counsel should be appointed to investigate what happened to those fees. Were they used to pay for trips, which is not permitted? Who was paying for all those trips to the Marianas by these members of Congress and their staffs and their families? And what other money might have been paid? We know the garment industry paid at least $650,000 into the U.S. Family Network, which is a nonprofit that was set up by Tom DeLay and some of his key people, Ed Buckham, former chief of staff, very involved with Abramoff. So, you know, where was this money going and where did it end up? There doesn't seem to be much focus on that. We're looking instead at the Indian gambling interests in the U.S., but what about the Marianas and what's going to happen to these women who are stranded there now? What can be done to help them?
The article in Ms. quotes a letter Jack Abramoff wrote to the governor of the Marianas in which he said, "We've worked with the White House Office of Presidential Personnel to ensure that the Mariana relevant positions at various agencies are not awarded to enemies of the Marianas." What do you know about that note?
Yes, Jack Abramoff was bragging about yet another success that he pulled off for the Marianas. When Bush was elected president and decisions were being made who to place into the appointed positions at the Department of the Interior, which had oversight of the Marianas, and the Department of the Labor, which, of course, deals with minimum wage as well as violations of labor laws, to be sure that some of Abramoff's former law partners or people who were on his lobbying team at Greenberg Traurig and the Gates Law Firm, in fact, got appointments. Assistant Secretary of Labor was a former Abramoff associate. Appointments at the Department of the Interior, former associates of Abramoff. So he was very quick to make sure that he was able to influence some of these appointments in the new Bush administration to make sure that regulatory action wouldn't be taken or investigations wouldn't be launched into what was happening in the Marianas.
After I read your article, I noticed that I have some T-shirts that say "Made in the Marianas parentheses USA." Why don't you explain the changes that labeling has gone through from clothing that is made in factories in the Marianas?
Actually, I mean, they could still just say made in the USA if they wanted to, but under tremendous pressure, frankly, brought about by a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit on behalf of the workers in the Marianas, Global Exchange, Sweatshop Watch, Unite, the labor union that deals with garment industry, brought lawsuits against the factory owners in the Marianas, challenging their labor violations, some of the immigration violations as well, but also challenging their right to claim that their garments were made in the USA. And so under real pressure, the garment industry began changing all of that. And today, most of the garments that are manufactured there do say made in Saipan, parentheses USA, or made in the Northern Marianas, parentheses USA. So at least you now know where those garments are coming from. But I think a lot of consumers were fooled into thinking that they were buying clothing that was made by USA workers in USA factories with decent standards, never even dreaming that they were supporting a sweatshop, virtually slave labor situation on a territory of the United States.
Well, thank you for talking with us about this story in Ms. Magazine. Thank you both.
Thank you, Terry.
Catherine Spiller is the executive editor of Ms. Magazine. Rebecca Claren wrote the article we've been discussing on the Mariana Islands. Coming up, the maternity homes where many unwed pregnant women used to go to hide their pregnancies. This is Fresh Air. In the decades before abortion was legalized, many unwed pregnant women were sent away to maternity homes where they could keep their pregnancies hidden from their own communities. Typically, these women were urged to give up their babies for adoption and were expected to then return home as if nothing ever happened. My guest, Anne Fessler, is the author of the new book, The Girls Who Went Away. Fessler is an adoptee. Her birth mother was one of those women who was sent away to a maternity home. Fessler's new book is based on conversations with her birth mother and on interviews with over 100 other women who were between the ages of 15 and 35 when they were pregnant. Your book is about how a lot of unwed pregnant women were sent away from home in the 40s, 50s, and 60s to keep their pregnancies hidden. Remind us of what the climate was like that made a lot of families feel like it was necessary to send the women away.
The climate at that time in post-World War II America was that many families were gaining ground economically. They were socially mobile. They were moving up. And at that time, to have an unmarried pregnant daughter was associated with bad mothering and low social status. So despite the fact that this was really a very frequent occurrence in middle-class families, they could afford to cover it up. They could afford to send their daughter out of town and essentially have her come back and say that she was, you know, visiting a sick aunt or had an opportunity to go to Europe or something to cover the story and then sort of reintegrate into her her middle-class lifestyle.
And of course, if the girl was in high school and was pregnant, she would be expelled after she started to show,
immediately.
Most likely. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, until 1974, part of the Title IX amendment prevented schools from expelling pregnant young women, both high schools and colleges. And up until that time, many of the schools, immediately upon learning that a young woman was pregnant, they expelled her immediately. She had to leave the school. Her education was interrupted, and the maternity homes did have some educational. If they were large enough, they offered classes to the young women who were in high school, and some of them finished out their education at the maternity home.
So what were the maternity homes like?
A lot of the young women say it was like being in a going away to camp or being in a large dorm, in the sense that they might have in some cases they shared a room. Most cases they shared a room. In some cases they had large rooms that would have, you know, 12 beds in a room, and they essentially they were confined to that maternity home. Occasionally they would go out in groups, but they basically had activities to occupy the women's time. Younger women very often could not leave the maternity home unless they were with supervision of some kind. Sometimes older women could go out in small groups. So during the day, they usually had a list of chores, and they was like scrubbing the kitchen floors or helping in the kitchen or making beds, and then arts and crafts classes and sewing and various domestic activities to occupy their time. One of the things that seemed somewhat remarkable to me is what was not really done at the maternity homes in most of them was to give the women classes in childbirth and to give them some instruction and information about what was to come.
Well, most of the women you interviewed complained to you they were completely unprepared for childbirth.
Absolutely. First of all, at this time, there was so little sex education, so there was no information about sex or pregnancy, and in the maternity home, you have a rather captive audience. They're all going to give birth, yet in most cases, they did not really tell the women anything about what to expect, and they were terrified of giving birth. They had no idea what was to come.
And most of them in the maternity homes went through labor alone. I guess they didn't have family with them.
No, apparently, in most cases, it was the policy to not call the family until after the birth. And so they were very often driven to the hospital and dropped off at the front door by staff at the maternity home. And they went in and admitted themselves pregnant and in labor. And they were instructed to tell people at the front desk that they were from the home. And then they were sort of whisked into a room and prepped for delivery. And they were put in a room. Very often they were left by themselves. There was no one there to be with them or hold their hand or give them any explanation of what was happening to their bodies. And then at some point they were taken into the labor room, and in some cases they were knocked out completely, so they would theoretically have no memory, or so they would have no memory of the birth and theoretically then not suffer the loss. And in other cases they were awake during the birth of their child, but there was absolutely no hand-holding with this birth.
Were the maternity homes linked up with adoption agencies so that after the women staying at the maternity home gave birth, the baby would go to a specific adoption agency?
In some cases, they were. During the pregnancy, certainly there would be caseworkers assigned, and the women would be talking to a social worker, and it was clear, I mean, 80% of the women who went into the maternity homes surrendered their children. So it was somewhat of a foregone conclusion that this was going to be the case. On that's how the social workers and adoption workers felt. And so when a woman actually tried to protest and said that, you know, to the people at the maternity home that she was not, did not want to surrender her child, essentially she received a kind of barrage of a sort of litany of these reasons why, if she loved her child, she had to surrender. And that was that there were better parents waiting, that she was unfit because she was unwed, that she was, you know, a bad girl, and her only option was to surrender.
What kind of communities did the maternity homes tend to be located in? And was there much interaction between the girls and young women who were sent to the homes and the people who lived in that same neighborhood?
Some of the homes were located in, you know, very nice neighborhoods, and some were located in very bad neighborhoods. And so one woman I interviewed in California had gone to a home in Los Angeles, and she had some very some terrible incidences where whenever the young women would go out of the home, neighbors would throw things at them, and, you know, people would, a lot of women reported that people would drive by and yell names at the home, you know, you whores, you know, that sort of thing. And but the woman in Los Angeles said that she had gone to a home that was in a fairly bad neighborhood, and that you know, they were often pelted with, you know, eggs and tomatoes and things like that when they left the home.
Now, this is a very personal story for you, because you were adopted, and you eventually tracked down the woman who gave birth to you and found out her story. Her story is not unlike a lot of the stories that you tell in your book. Now, you were told by your mother, the woman who adopted you and brought you up, you were told mm-hmm. by her the story of your birth parents. But when you met the mother who gave birth to you, the story turned out to be different than what you were told.
Yes.
So tell us the story that you grew up with, and then tell us the story as it was told to you by the woman who actually gave birth to you.
Right. Okay. I should also say that was quite common. The agencies very often sort of trumped up the description of the adopting family as part of the process of convincing a young woman that her child would be better off with somebody else besides her. But in the case of, in my case, my family was told that my mother and my father had been dating for a long time, that he was a football player, and he was from a family of means, and that his family did not want him to drop out of college and ruin his life, and therefore they were prevented from getting married, which always sounded a little bit like a plot from a movie to me. But anyway, that's the story I was told. And when I met my mother, I discovered that that was not the case, and that she actually had been dating this young man. He was not in college. He was not a college football player. They had been dating, and they broke up, and she met someone else, and that someone else was the man that she was going to marry. And she did not know that she was pregnant when she met the man that she wanted to marry. And the story that I was told was fictitious, or that my parents were told was fictitious.
And did your mother want to give you up for adoption?
I believe yes. She was in a situation where she felt that it's not quite as simple as that, but certainly.
But she didn't feel coerced.
No, she was not one of the women who felt coerced. She was one of the women that did have an option presented to her, and though it may not have really been a viable option for her, because her husband-to-be said he would be willing to allow her to essentially bring me home. But that, in small town America, that would not have been an easy thing to deal with, because certainly as I grew up, it would have been obvious that I was not part of that couple, of that family, should I say. So even though, and he would have been actually blamed in the beginning for getting her pregnant, so to speak, before marriage. So people would have assumed, at least temporarily, that he was the father of her baby, and that's why they got married. As I aged, I think I would have looked nothing like either of them, and it would have been clear that I was someone else's child. And none of those things would have been very easy in small-town America. I was born in 1949. So it would have made their lives incredibly difficult.
My guest is Anne Fessler. Her new book is called The Girls Who Went Away. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anne Fessler, and her new book is called The Girls Who Went Away. Now, you learned that your birth mother actually went to one of the maternity homes, the kind of home that you wrote about in your new book. What home did she go to, and what was her experience like there?
She went to a Florence Crittenden home, and she went away when she was 7.5 months pregnant, I believe, almost 8 months pregnant. And she never told her, she never had a conversation with her mother about this. She told her father that she was pregnant, and he actually came to visit her while she was in the home, which could not have been easy for him to do. He was a farmer, and he needed to be home and taking care of the animals and the farm. And he made a trip to visit her, and but she never told her mother, and she said she thought that probably her father told her mother, but she didn't know. She never said anything to her.
Now, your adoptive mother was adopted herself, but her mother, your grandmother, never told her that she was adopted. She found this out on her own.
That's right. I think in my mother's era, it was... an adopted child was a little bit more of a secret, and I think that was because, she grew up at a time when, part of a woman's role was to produce offspring for their husband, and there was some shame associated with not being able to bear children. And so she tried to ask her mother at one point about her adoption, and her mother essentially told her, don't ever bring that subject up again. And so that was the end of the discussion with her mother, and it was hurtful to her that she could not talk to her mother about it. But she did have confirmation that she was adopted. She found some paperwork that was taped to the back of a painting in her aunt's house, and it clarified that she was adopted. And on that adoption certificate, she had been named Baby Helene. And so when she brought me home from the hospital, she named me Anne Helene.
The woman who adopted you was adopted herself. Do you think, I don't know if she talked to you about this at all, but do you think the fact that she was adopted affected at all how she felt as an adoptive mother?
Because my mother was adopted, my adoptive mother was adopted herself, she was not told by her own mother, she felt it was very important to talk about adoption and not to have adoption be a kind of secretive thing in the family. So she would talk constantly about, waiting for the phone call and how she couldn't wait, to bring my brother and I home. And she always framed it in terms of, going to get us and how, and that process for her. And she acknowledged that I was of some other woman, it might be a way to put it. As a matter of fact, she told me, I don't remember this because I was too young, but she told me that on my first three birthdays, she lit a special candle on my birthday cake for my mother. And so she herself always sort of acknowledged that her joy was built on somebody else's pain. And so she was very empathetic to, this unknown young woman who she said, was not able to take care of me. And so that was very openly acknowledged in my family.
Well, Ann Fessler, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ann Fessler is the author of The Girls Who Went Away. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. From BMW, where ideas are everything. And as an independent company, they have the freedom to let those ideas live on. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. And from audible.com. where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the New York Times first ombudsman, Daniel Okrent, talks about his new book. It collects his columns along with reflections, reconsiderations, and a few retractions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.